quite an experience to live in fear, isn't it? That's what it is to be a slave.
PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody, and welcome to the bunker. It is April the 25th.
2006, just past 7, bunker savings time, and that is, of course, UTC minus 5, in case you're keeping score.
And if that isn't enough numbers for you, 47, 29, 31, Mike.
We've got plenty of numbers to talk about tonight, and we've got the first part of a great interview with J.B. Fields, who's an interesting fellow in many more ways than one. I, in doing a little research into Mr. Fields, discovered that he's credited with creating the online electronic newsletter.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. But what's even more interesting is what he's going to tell us about the case of Susan Lindauer, former reporter and congressional aide, who's now being held, charged with being an unregistered agent for a foreign country. And, well, she's being held until she submits to being drugged, basically, mm-hmm. by the government.
You know, Jay Fields is a very interesting man, and I think you're really going to enjoy the interview. But you are going to find yourself wanting to throw things mm-hmm. as you listen to what the government is putting this woman through. So you don't want to miss that. We'll have parts 2 and 3 up tomorrow and the next day.
But we got a lot to talk about, a lot to talk about. Many things happening in the world as we come, as we bring April to a conclusion here. Today, the trial of Father Gerald Robinson got underway. That is the case in Toledo, Ohio, in which a Roman Catholic priest is accused of a murder that occurred 26 years ago, 1980, and very strange, we'll just very quickly cover it. Sister Mary Ann Paul, Margaret Ann Paul, was killed in the chapel of a hospital in Toledo, mm-hmm. Ohio, in a ritualistic manner. She'd gone into the sacristy, which is where the Holy Eucharist is kept, in Roman Catholic faith, and between Good Friday and Easter Sunday to prepare for the evening mass. While she was there, she was strangled nearly to death, and while still alive, was stabbed 31 times.
31 times, and apparently 9 of those mm-hmm. were in a cross shape over her heart.
Yes, apparently a crucifix was laid over her chest, upside down, and 9 stab wounds were made around the shape of the cross, and then 21 more stab wounds were made around her body. So some very occultic...
22 more.
Yes, 22. I'm sorry, 11 times 11 times 2. Yes,
those are very curious numbers, 9 and 22.
And of course, 31 is a reversed 13. Mm-hmm. So it is a case that has just filled with occult symbolism, and so we will keep an eye on how that case progresses.
You know, it has been quite a day. There are many stories that watch your news that you really need to take a look at, and if you aren't getting that newsletter yet, you can always subscribe. Just send us a note at subscribe at watchermagazine.com. You know, the whole gasoline thing, mm-hmm. arm and a leg, firstborn child, prices at the pump. Mm-hmm. And that's a nice way of putting it. Of course, we've all seen some others that really aren't really all that nice.
Yes, not user-friendly.
Yes. LOL. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Bill Gates apparently owns 25.5% of Pacific Ethanol.
Well, he's a smart guy.
He is a smart guy. And here we've got an administration that is now suddenly pushing ethanol. Ethanol's been around for a long time. Mm-hmm. And suddenly it's like, wait a minute, we can make a fuel out of corn.
Yeah. Brazil has basically made itself more or less energy independent by, you know, setting for processing ethanol out of sugar. And, you know, we could have done it all along, which would have benefited the American farmer, somebody who really needs a hand, without having to put, mm-hmm. you know, just basically government checks in their hands, mm-hmm. which, you know, from the farmers I know, and you know, my grandparents were farmers.
Yeah.
They would rather work for the money rather than just stand around and be paid not to grow stuff.
Everyone that I knew felt that way. In fact, back in Nebraska, mm-hmm. most of the guys that I knew who were farming just simply did not want to take any government handouts.
Right.
You know, they would rather let their field just rot. Mm-hmm. Then take a handout.
And what's really ridiculous is that the government, you know, is setting guidelines, setting, you know, projections for how much ethanol they think we're going to need in order to meet certain, you know, goals for reducing oil consumption. And because we fell like 5% short in projected ethanol production for the year or something like that. I didn't follow the story very closely. But basically, because the projection of the ethanol that we can produce isn't quite up to what the government said they thought we were going to need, okay? There's a lot of ifs and what ifs in you know, the scenario I'm laying out here. Based on that, the price of gasoline has jumped up to $2.79 a gallon for regular here in St. Louis, and it's up over $3 everywhere else. Like, whoa, well, I guess we better raise the price of gasoline some more.
So it's the farmer's fault, huh?
No. It's
I know what you're saying. Well, it's really funny. I was looking on Drudge today, and he posted a note that as Bush went to his speech today, he drove by, or his car drove by, a gas station that had these really high prices on it, and out there in Texas, and apparently he made comment about it. And, of course, his speech went right on to saying, we're going to suspend any donations to the reserve that we normally keep for emergencies here in the United States. And that will be until fall. We won't be putting anything in there at all. Well, I hope there's no emergency.
Yeah.
Because I'll be honest, I doubt that that's going to have much effect on gas prices.
It's not. It's all speculative. It's, you know, you might as well be buying and selling baseball cards, you know, for all of the connection that the price of oil has to reality.
Baseball cards.
Yeah, we do, actually. Can we burn
baseball.
Them for fuel?
we may end up doing that.
They might be more useful that way.
You know, speaking of fuel, old Halliburton, our good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a story that's come out today from the New York Times that apparently Halliburton, in a no-bid contract when they were reconstructing Iraq, somehow they've just not lived up to their, you know, agreement. They failed to do what they were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is sadly just one more part of a bigger picture that's emerging from Iraq, and that an awful lot of infrastructure is being left uncompleted because a lot more money was required to just pay for basic things like security for workers who were being shot at than they expected. This particular pipeline at Halliburton 1 was a $75.7 million project, which is just being left uncompleted. In fact, the only project I'm aware of in Iraq that is being completed on time and under budget is the mega embassy. Yeah, but the mega embassy that we're building, which we remind you is 10 times larger than any other American embassy in the world.
Everything else,
you know, the power plants, the water pumping stations and purification stations and the oil pipelines even are being left uncompleted.
This just makes no sense at all when you look at the whole price of oil.
Mm-hmm.
And we are not even bothering to complete pipelines that might somehow help with that.
Yeah. This particular pipeline called the Fatah pipeline is part of a $2.4 billion, that's billion with a B, no bid contract that Halliburton won to rebuild 15 pipelines. Okay, or across the Tigris River.
After we'd bombed them.
After we'd bombed them, probably, yeah. Which is the main link between the northern oil fields in Iraq, around Mosul and Kirkuk, to the export terminals and refineries down in the south of Iraq. In other words, this is a critical piece of infrastructure that needs to be completed if this country is ever going to get back on its feet. And it's just being left undone.
Well, the curious thing about that is I think one could say, well, then it's not about the oil.
Possibly. Or,
I mean, if Halliburton doesn't even seem to care if they get that built or not, then why are we really there?
Well, my theory is, and this is something Debka File reported on some time ago, and I've seen other speculation about this on the web, you know, over the last couple of years, that the plan all along has been to carve Iraq into three separate zones. Mm-hmm. You've got the northern part of Iraq, which would basically be the new Kurdish homeland.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the central part of Iraq, which would mainly be Sunni. And then you've got the southern part of Iraq, which, like Iran, would be Shiite.
Right.
And that is what appears to be happening. And the longer Iraq is left in a state of turmoil, basically civil war, the more likely it is that that's going to be the ultimate solution. Order out of chaos.
Oh.
We can't possibly force these people to get along, so we're just going to break them up into three autonomous zones. with us as their overlords, I mean protectors.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and speaking of that, there's a story from northern Iraq from Debka File that the Shiite militia under the control of Muqtada al-Sadr, the Mahdi army, is moving into Mosul and or Kirkuk, rather, which is one of the big oil-producing regions, to try to keep it from falling into Kurdish hands. And the Kurds are responding by bringing their Peshmerga fighters in force. So we may see that area erupt into violence here in the near future.
Well, you know, speaking of Iraq, there's also a story coming out of the Telegraph that UK paratroopers, an organization called the SAS, are disguising themselves as U.S. soldiers.
Well, the paratroopers are part of a group that have been deployed to assist
the
SAS.
Yes, but why are they?
See, the SAS.
The SAS is British.
Right. The SAS is Special Air Service, and they've been.
But they are dressing as U.S. soldiers.
Well, the paratroopers who are assisting the SAS.
Oh, okay.
But yeah,
sorry.
But you're right. Your point is well taken, though, that British soldiers
That's
are being
my whole
deployed.
Point. Why aren't they dressing as British soldiers, not U.S. soldiers?
Yeah, because they don't look like Americans and they don't act like Americans, and so they don't attract the same kind of attention as Americans, apparently. But they seem to appreciate, according to the article, the fact that they get to play with American toys when they go out on patrol. So,
well,
yeah,
at least
it
they're not dressed as Iraqis.
Yeah, which some of the SAS guys have done.
Exactly.
Yeah, the guys who were captured last fall in down south in Basra. Yeah, it is interesting that British soldiers are being deployed as Americans, which seems to me to be widening the British involvement in what's going on in Iraq. Now, why would they be doing that? Are they taking up roles that American soldiers would be filling?
I don't know. I just think it's really bizarre. As you say, you're right. I had misread, but they are there to cover the SAS.
Yeah. And
their fellow Brits.
Mm-hmm.
Just dress in your own uniforms, guys.
Yeah, why are they deploying these guys in American uniforms? That is really unusual.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, the idea is to send a signal that Americans are still on patrol here when, in fact, American soldiers are being redeployed for something else.
It's intentional that they look like Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree. Well, speaking of troubles in the area, well, just geopolitical stuff all around, there's a story that we heard Steve Quayle talk about last night, Monday night, and I tracked down the article today in Rio Novosti, which is a good news source out of Moscow.
I use it a lot.
Yeah. Their military, Russia's military, flew undetected through the United States-controlled zone over the Arctic Ocean into Canada during a recent military exercise. They sent long-range bombers, Tu-160 Blackjacks and Tu-95 Bears, without being spotted on American radar or visually by American spotters. And according to a Russian Lieutenant General Igor Kovorov, the United States Air Force is now investigating why these Russian bombers got through our defense screen without being detected.
Well, let me bring this up if we're going to talk about Russia. Apparently, now we talked about this warhead that they claim they have, this missile they claim they have that will essentially render all of our anti-missile defenses useless.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they tested it again, and it's a hybrid warhead. And they're coming out, they're very open about this.
Mm-hmm.
And very open about the fact that this is specifically made to undo the U.S. defenses.
Yeah.
Now, that's an odd statement to make, considering that Russia is supposed to be our friend, right?
That's right. We're your friends. We're your friends. Yeah. They are deploying a new type of warhead which can be configured as a MIRV, which is a multiple independently targetable reentry vehicle.
Or a talk show host.
Oh, yes, a MIRV Griffin. The difficulty with the MIRV is that they can send the rocket in one direction, but then you can split three or four warheads off into different directions all of a sudden, and very difficult to try to knock down, even if you do have an anti-missile device that can project the trajectory of where the rocket is headed. It is interesting that Russia is making this known so soon after that Foreign Affairs article was published.
Mm-hmm. I know, and that's why I agree. I find it so interesting.
Yes.
They're trying to send a message back.
Exactly.
And I would bet that things are happening, but, you know, in channels that you and I are not going to hear about.
Know nothing about, right. Yeah, this exactly. is just the stuff that's going out publicly.
Well, you know what? We could go on and on, but we have a guest. Mm-hmm. We don't want to take up any more of his time. But you know what? This interview with J.B. Fields is one that you're truly going to find disturbing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. He is well, we'll let him tell the story, but he is probably better situated than just about anyone else to relay the story of Susan Lindauer.
Mm-hmm. And those of you who enjoyed the interview with Janet Phelan, she is the one who let us know about this and suggested that we call him and see if we couldn't work out an interview. So here's for part one with J.B. Fields.
We're pleased to welcome to our guest line Jay Fields. He was got a very interesting story to tell, and we've sort of teased it a little bit in the shows last week. Well, I guess the just dive right in. Welcome to PID Radio.
Thank you.
Now, you kind of fell into a rather interesting situation between an American citizen and the United States government when you took a new apartment. Can you just basically tell us what happened and how you came to meet Susan Lindauer?
Sure. Well, as you said, I was looking for an apartment in the D.C. area, and I just kind of returned to the area and got on Craigslist and found a woman that was helping somebody else fill a vacancy, and it seemed to fit the bill. Came in and moved in and enjoyed, I saw a situation to me definitely looked desperate in some respect. I could tell that she needed the first month's rent and the deposit to pay for a furnace to be put in, if she might be without heat for the winter.
Oh.
And for me at the time, I'd been through a rather significant accident, and I sort of looked at the whole situation saying, well, I've been wondering what good could come from all the things that have happened to me recently, and here's somebody who seems to need help more than I do, and I couldn't turn away from the situation. And we basically, I ended up moving in, a couple weeks later, I had a job offer from a government contractor, and it depended on my security clearance being updated. And I went up and knocked on her door and said, well, the FBI is going to come around asking some questions about me, perhaps. And if they do, please cooperate with them, because, it's for a job that I want to be able to get this job. And I haven't done anything wrong, that kind of thing. And she looks at me and says, well, I don't know if you can get a security clearance living here. And that was the first I heard of what her troubles were.
Now, what was the reason for your security clearance? You have a government job, or?
I did at the time, and until recently. I may yet, again, have another government job. But at the moment, I work as a free agent, a Microsoft trainer. I travel around the country teaching networking classes and project management and network security and things like that.
Okay. So did she explain to you why she made a statement like that?
Well, it really caught me by surprise, and when I found out more, it scared the dickens out of me, but we kind of stuck to our guns. I wasn't in a position to come up with more money to move, and it turned out that the security clearance came through in record time, even though I did go to people make sure that they were appraised of the situation. Now, I guess it's a good time to kind of lead into what the situation was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it turned out that she told me that she'd been arrested on March 10th of 2004 for being an unregistered agent of Iraq intelligence. And that is as scary as it sounds. The basic violation was really amounts to being an unregistered lobbyist.
Right.
And then what they did is it would appear to me that they flowered up the language a lot to try to make something look more sinister than it was, or to help them, increase some drama to help it, get to court and get whatever other powers they wanted and to get an eventual conviction. And what she had done, and to talk about Susan now having lived here for a little bit more than a year and witnessed all that's gone on in her life from my seat. To understand it, you have to go back quite a bit further to the Lockerbie trials.
Okay.
She she gave a deposition at the Lockerbie trials.
Mm-hmm.
That implicated, well, it didn't implicate it, but well, yeah, it, she said that as that while she had been a staffer for one of the congresswomen on the Hill, that she had met a Dr. Fuse, who she gathered worked, had been a former bureau chief for the CIA in Syria.
Okay.
And this guy had told her that we were prosecuting the wrong people at Lockerbie, that he could point out, identify the real culprits if he were to see them in the coffee shop across, you know, across the way at any time, and that the real culprits were a bunch of Assyrians, and she had the names for these people. They're essentially, they're the same people who went on to commit the World Trade Center attacks.
Hmm.
The, she gave this deposition and saying that, that Dr. Fuse could not testify because he was under himself, because he was under an oath of silence. And as a consequence or a result of her deposition, there is in the Scottish press a copy, and you can Google this and come up with a PDF. There's a copy of the letter that the CIA provided to the court, and I gather to the United Nations, and it in very plain language says that we release Dr. Fuse from his oath of silence in these matters. And it doesn't equivocate as to whether or not he worked for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, her connection to Dr. Fuse is a matter of history.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I'm looking at the copy of the deposition right now, which was published by the Middle East Intelligence Bulletin, Daniel Pipes' publication.
Yeah, right. That's online as well.
Right.
So, you know, I've spent some time wondering how, you know, what I'd wandered into and certainly did my research. And this of course, well, okay, to continue, she had worked previously as a journalist. Her dad was a Republican candidate for governor in Alaska. Her cousin was Andy Card, who was the president's former chief of staff, or I guess is that former chief of staff.
He's her second cousin, isn't that right?
That's correct, second cousin. So, you know, she's somewhat connected to people who are used to being in you know, kind of important positions in world events.
Right.
And she'd grown up around the oil business and was acquainted with a number of Arabs and Arab ways of thinking. She went to Smith College and had a professor there who was a big critic, I guess a noted critic, against the use of sanctions to affect foreign relations. She then went on to the London School of Economics. So she's nobody's dummy.
She is no slouch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She became involved after Lockerbie in, you know, meeting different diplomats, and she talks about dinner she had with the ambassador from Yemen and conveying some information to him about expected attacks and not realizing that the attacks were going to target American assets in his harbors, and that was ended up being the start. She claims to have actually met in earlier years, met Osama bin Laden, and later on, when the French were looking for some people who had been involved in some bombing, was able to provide Interpol some information that they'd reinvestigated some old leads and were able to track some things down. So sounds like, you know, to hear her, I've only heard her side of this, but
right.
But she has names and dates and is very coherent in describing these activities in ways that seem to me to be pretty credible. And I got to admit that I've been around the government for over 25 years and started out, you know, writing submarines in the Navy and a few years as a, you know, junior computer person at the State Department, and you know, nothing policy or anything, but it just fit. You know, everything she said pretty much seemed to square up, and she had great command of dates and times and names and that kind of thing. Well, after the election, I think I have the chronology of this right. Iraq became very interested in getting in out of the cold, and they invited her up to New York at first to meet with their delegation in New York. And then they invited her to Baghdad to meet with them there. And mm-hmm. she claims that she went to Dr. Fuse again and told him about this and said, well, should I go do this? I can. I think I got some money coming in. I can do this. And he says, oh, no, don't you pay for this. Make them pay for this to prove they're serious. And she did. She went and she had this meeting and came back and wrote her cousin about the what transpired in the meeting. She's written a few other letters, including letters to Vice President Cheney, and I've come into custody of some of those, and published one of them on the internet myself. But the gist of the letters were that they wanted the weapons of mass, that they wanted the weapons inspectors back. They recognized that there had been something of a cease. There was going to be something of a change with the new administration. And they also request, now this is in the late 2000 and early months of 2001, requested that we send the FBI to help them root out any Al-Qaeda elements in Iraq.
Really?
An Iraqi delegation met with her in early 2001 and asked for the inspectors to come back and for the FBI to come in and help them get Al-Qaeda out?
Specifically to help them get any Al-Qaeda elements out of Iraq. Now,
That is a mind-blower.
It is. Now, let's for a moment, though, not go to extremes. And I mean, this is exciting stuff. It's newsworthy stuff. But I'm not going to sit here and say that I would expect her cousin or the government to turn on its heels and give credence to any of this.
Sure,
at that
right.
point. No. Saddam Hussein had been jerking the previous administration around for at least 8 years, shooting at our planes in the no-fly zone. Back-channel diplomacy itself has kind of a bad reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what Susan's relationship with her second cousin before his election was an open question.
Do you think that's why they chose her?
Pardon?
Do you think that's part of the reason they chose her?
Well, certainly part of the reason, in my mind, why Iraq invited her. Other than her, I think she had a lot of credibility because she'd been working to end sanctions in one venue and another.
Mm-hmm.
So she looked like a person friendly to their interests. But I think her blood relation connection to the administration was something that the Iraqis would have thought to be quite important.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think they kind of bet the farm on her. And you know, it's a matter of history that they have chemical weapons because once upon a time we gave them to them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
But I would not doubt that with what they saw in the future and the interest in bringing some of these games to a conclusion, and maybe, in my mind, maybe even people in our agencies wanting to affect change, working with them to find a way to remediate the relationship for other purposes longer term, saying, okay, it is time to find an end to these sanctions, and if weapons of mass destruction can be dealt with and we can move on in some constructive sense, great. And that's what she's more or less described the purpose of her mission to me, was that they were trying to gain some constructive opportunities and actually make Iraq come to the table with some hard things that they would do in exchange for improved relationships. So anyway, I don't necessarily blame the administration for not believing everything they read in that letter, but nevertheless, it's a darned interesting letter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it does kind of point to what may have been really going on in Iraq, whether we recognize it at the time or not. Okay, so move forward a little bit. That letter goes nowhere. Nobody pays any attention to it. We end up invading Iraq. After the invasion and the lack of weapons inspection shows, a lack of weapons of mass destruction found, Then we begin this language of we're going to have an investigation into intelligence failures. And she gets all excited about what baloney this is and starts going to members of Congress saying, look, not everybody in the agencies was asleep. I know people who were trying to do the job and weren't being listened to. And here's my information. Here's what we were trying to do in Baghdad. And in short order after that, she was indicted. And this is more than a year after she'd written the letter. I think it's almost 2 years.
Yeah.
She was finally indicted. When was the invasion of Iraq? Do you remember the date?
It was March of 03.
Yeah.
March of 03. So it's exactly a year later then.
Yeah.
And never mind that she was writing letters to these people. The letters that she wrote were in 2000 and 2001. So the invasion's 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year after the invasion, she's finally indicted. Well, so my guess is, I'm not remembering the chronology exactly, but my guess would be that those intelligence investigations must have been in the 2003 timeframe.
Mm-hmm.
And now, the New York Times story talks about a Libyan agent that they used in investigating her. She tells me that 2 days after she appealed to Trent Lott's office as to what to do with the information she had, that within 2 days the grand jury was convened and she was indicted. So that would have been in March 2004. But the New York Times reports about an FBI agent who was used to investigate her, who asked her to leave information for him in different places around Tacoma Park, I guess one or two places. And she had a roommate at the time who was, I guess, a professor in Toronto at the university up there in information technology. And he was a boarder here, like I am now, and frequently went to dinner with her and remembers the conversation that they had when this popped up. And she's saying, well, this guy's no Libyan intelligence agent. I don't know who he is or what he's up to. But anyway, she was kind of, I think, playing his hand to figure out where he was going and maybe even looking for what opportunities there might be for her to make some money off of him. Who knows, okay? I don't know what her motives might have been. But that agent basically reported that she had given him information on the whereabouts of Iraqi expatriates in this country who were hiding from Saddam Hussein, and agreed to assist resistance efforts to an American invasion. Okay, so that's kind of as much as I know about in terms of why she was indicted.
Now
the indictment, if that was true, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Go ahead. Question?
Actually, I was going to ask, when exactly did she offer her assistance to withstand an American invasion? Was that prior to March of 2003 or after?
That would have been prior to I don't know. My guess is it was after, because I'm thinking that she went to them with the intelligence failures. Now, she says that she was indicted the indictment came within 2 days, but that would have been in March of 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no way that this all happened in 2 days with the intelligence agent.
Right.
And I don't know whether it was before or after the invasion. The National Review says it was, or reading what the National Review says, I get the impression it was after. And indeed, that's pretty serious, but let's look at that for a second. If it was true, then they would have done something besides charge her as an unregistered lobbyist.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's treason, I think. And she's not being accused of that. Now, maybe they bring more charges in time. I don't know. But it seems to me that somebody wanted her out of the way. They had a technical charge that she'd gone to Congress and written these letters, and she hadn't registered with the Attorney General to represent a foreign agent. And then they flowered it up a little bit with some of the language of the Patriot Act in order to gain the opportunity to do some things that otherwise, you know, they wouldn't be able to do, such as what ended up happening is they sent her to prison without a trial.
Okay, hold it there, because we're going to have to address that tomorrow, because we're running out of time for today.
We'll continue our discussion with Jay Fields on the strange case of Susan Lindauer tomorrow on PID Radio.
Well, that takes us to the end of part one. You don't want to miss parts two and three, and those will be up for downloading, up for down, as of tomorrow and the next day on Thursday.
There has been some new developments in the case, and mm-hmm. we did mention them last night, or allude to them anyway. Susan has been moved to a federal facility in New York.
Right.
And she will be in federal court on May the 4th. The court is holding a hearing on whether or not to declare her incompetent and commit her permanently to a mental hospital and forcibly medicate her.
Yeah, and if we, you know, if whatever's in the news that will that follows up on that, we'll definitely keep you abreast of that. But also, if we hear from Jay or we get a chance to chat with him, we'll let you know what he has to say about that too. My prayer is that she'll actually be able to talk with her lawyer while she's up there. That was my big thing. Is not only there, are they keeping her, you know, really without any kind of resolution and no trial, but the lawyer is in New York. She was in Texas.
Right.
We'll just pray that that works.
Well, I'll put a link in the show notes at PIDradio.com to Jay Fields' blog, and he's got a post which lays out his assessment of the situation as of yesterday, April 24th, and he doesn't hold the public defender who's representing Susan in very high regard.
No, he doesn't. He's a really interesting man.
Yes, he is.
So
yes, he is.
I think you'll enjoy parts two and three of that. By the way, coming up next month, we've got Prophecy Month for PID Radio. We're lining up some really great guests, so you don't want to miss next month.
Sharon exchanged a whole bunch of great email today. She was just letting fly and lining up guests. But of course, we'll start things off with Russ Dizdar. We're going to talk a little bit about some strange things that have been happening in Pennsylvania Dutch country over the last couple of weeks, but we'll also touch on the Black Awakening, which he's talked about before, and again, that falls right into the prophetic end time scenario that is laid out in the Bible.
It does, and we're also going to be speaking with Ken Parsons and also with Rick Wiles. And possibly some of your old favorites. We're going to try to get David Lowe back here, maybe Peter Goodgame, and maybe even Mike Kaiser. We're going to be making some phone calls. So if you have a favorite that you'd like to interview, we may even be able to squeeze in two different interviews during a week.
Yeah.
Boy, that's asking a lot, isn't it?
Well, it's worth it, though.
You know,
because
it is.
You know, June the 6th is coming up, and of course, that's when that movie, The Beast, is coming out, 6-6 of 06. And we just think that as good Bereans, or in the spirit of the Bereans, who were praised by Paul for double-checking everything that he said against Scripture to make sure that he was being accurate and truthful, that we need to go back and do the same thing and make sure that we're prepared. Because, frankly, a lot of the things that are coming out right now that seem to be attacks on Christianity really aren't, if you know what you believe and if you know why you believe it. Frankly, the Da Vinci Code is pretty lame when you compare it against history and against traditional Christian doctrine. All of the hoo-ha about the Gospel of Judas, as Dr. Craig Evans pointed out last week, when you actually examine it in light of biblical Christianity, is pretty lame. And, you know, Mike Heiser said the same thing when we talked with him about the Da Vinci Code. And by the way, they just had the Da Vinci Code conference this past weekend, the 22nd. So those DVDs will be available for you very soon.
Oh, that's right. And we'll get one of those.
Yes, and we'll get a hold of Guy Malone to let us know when those will be ready for people to order. Because that, well, if you've heard Mike on this program or anywhere, you know that when he delivers information, it's he makes it very easy to understand, and it's always, always based on evidence.
Ah, so much going on and so little time. Well, I think that's going to have to wrap up another show. I hope you enjoyed today. If you want to send us a note, you can send us an email at radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And you're always welcome to comment or ask questions at the forum, where we've got a real interesting group of very intelligent people. Love to chew things over like this, and it's, of course, at peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
Slash. We hope not. Well, everybody have a wonderful evening, and we'll be back tomorrow with part two with J.B. Fields. In the meanwhile, I am Sharon Gilbert.
I'm Derek Gilbert. Thanks for listening to PID Radio.
Bye-bye, everybody. Gonna step up to the microphone. Say it loud.